I was going one evening to Martini's concert and was just entering the door of the hall when the Marchesina di F was coming out in a sort of a hurry. She was almost upon me before I saw her, so I gave a spring to one side to let her pass. She had done the same and on the same side too, so we ran our heads together. She instantly got to the other side to get out. I was just as unfortunate as she had been, for I had sprung to that side and opposed her passage again. We both flew together to the other side and then back and so on. It was ridiculous. In order for there to be communication, there needs to be a certain degree of unconsciousness and a certain degree of ignorance. If we constantly reflected about what others experience and how they are about to act or react to us, we would soon be in the same dilemma as the narrator of Laurence Sterne's A Sentimental Journey when encountering the Marchesina on the occasion of a concert by Giovanni Battista Martini at Milan. The term latency is one way to describe how this unconsciousness and ignorance works in favor of communication and social interaction. Latency can thereby be seen to result from the selectiveness and reduced complexity necessary to guarantee the self-maintenance of systemic structures while preventing them from the kind of collapse that an author like Sterne is so obviously fascinated by. This understanding of latency is, of course, Niklas Luhmann's. In systems theory, latency fulfills the function of protecting the structuredness of structures. It provides Latenz mit der Funktion des Strukturschutzes. On the other hand, as the example of Sterne's Sentimental Journey shows, narrative fictions could then be understood as the privileged site where this latent ground of social interaction can be experienced, enjoyed, engaged with, and actively practiced upon. What makes us read narratives and turn the pages back and over, what rouses our interest in what is actually happening and what happens next and why, is certainly also caused by the permanent breakthroughs of such social latencies. One further way to explain this specificity of interactions in fictional environments is to link latency with indirect practices of communications. Practices that Sterne's narrator too explicitly mentions when referring to the combined looks of simple subtlety where whim and sense and seriousness and nonsense are so blended that all the languages of Babel set loose together could not express them. They are communicated and caught so instantaneously that you can scarce say which party is the infector. When communicating in a direct or manifest way, it is impossible to state that you have not been communicating, see Václavik. In indirect or latent communication, by contrast, it can either be denied that something was communicated, no, that was just an involuntary twitch, or it can be denied that something was understood. Oh, sorry, I didn't get it. I thought that was just a twitch. Evidently, literary communication is to a great extent based on such indirect structures of communication. In literature, everything from what is told and what not to how it is told acts as a potential carrier of latent meaning. As a result, in various systems theoretical approaches towards literature, we find the idea that literary communication lives on the latencies typical of indirect communication. However, this approach towards latency and towards latency as a constituent of literary fiction in particular has serious limitations. By arguing that latency protects structures of communication, and by assuming that literary fictions bring these latencies to the fore, we are necessarily confined to an epistemological point of view. Such a concept of latency is, in other words, all about what we know and what we don't, and how conscious we are of what we are doing. This explanatory framework is limited, because it does not allow us to account for how latency is related to social ontologies, and in particular, to the modes of being that literary fictions provide. Yet, questions of social ontologies and what being social actually feels like and how it can engage and pledge us are part and parcel of what texts like Sterne's are mostly concerned with. Quite typical of the 18th century novel, A Sentimental Journey depicts social encounters that produce moments of suggestive fascinations, scenes in which the characters exert an imperious and, as it were, magical influence over each other, or in which they experience sensuously overwhelming enchantments with everyday objects. In this process, fictional agents, human or non-human, are shown to be closely and intensely connected to each other, and this connection, as Sterne's narrator never grows tired of repeating, involves translation. With the material, corporeal, and ontological frames of social interaction permanently shifting, the sense and the directions into which the character's discontinuous actions and ambivalent experiences will finally develop remain constitutively undetermined and crucially open for major or minor surprises. Referring back to his encounter with the Marquesina, the narrator adds, quote, that the connection which arose out of that translation gave me more pleasure than anyone I had the honor to make. This is how, and I was getting a bit too excited with that prezi, and so it's a bit twist and turn. So. This is how narrative fictions form an environment of transformative practice where experience unfolds its nature of change and its potential for radical novelty. Narrative fictions are fascinating not because they primarily challenge our understanding, but first and foremost because they provide an ontology of becoming and of continuous evolvement. Relating the concept of latency to this fictional production of novelty is quite impossible in the epistemological framework of systems theory. At the end of his remarks on latency, Luhmann admits this quite drastically. Systemic orders oriented towards functionality are not able to functionalize their own latencies because this would integrate these latencies into the system's own organization. What remains possible is only a kind of blind terrorism lacking function. Counter-contingency reduced to its sheer being. And I love the way Luhmann's getting crazy whenever he reaches the boundary, the boundaries of his own systems, and speaks of a blinder, funktionsloser Terrorismus. In the following, I am interested in precisely this counter-contingency, and I'm interested in how fictional modes of existence enable and confirm this counter-contingency in its sheer being. This requires, however, a quite different approach towards latency, and a good starting point is Cicero's Topica. Cicero's Topica deals with latency as an ontological mode of thought. His Topica is less about how we understand the world, but about the multifold nature of its existence. Cicero's work is dedicated to his protege Gaius Trebatius Testa, and it sets out to explain to his mentee what Aristotle wrote on the subject of finding arguments. Testa's being a jurist explains why Cicero mostly deals with arguments needed when presenting a legal case. Cicero hereby not only draws on Aristotle's own Topica, but also on his metaphysics. This is evident when Cicero mentions two ways of finding causal arguments by distinguishing two kinds of causes. One type of cause, which of its own force to a certainty produces that effect which is subordinate to it, as fire burns. The other is that which has no nature able to produce the effect in question, though still that effect cannot be produced without it, as if anyone were to say that brass was the cause of a statue, because a statue cannot be made without it. With the distinction between fire burns and brass is the cause of a statue, Cicero explicitly refers to the Aristotelian distinction between causa efficiens and causa materialis. However, the additional distinction between two types of material causes is, as far as I can see, entirely Cicero's own. The first type of material cause that Cicero mentions, and that falls under the class of brass as the cause of a statue, corresponds to Aristotle's definition as, quote, that as the result of whose presence something comes into being, for example, the bronze of a statue and the silver of a cup, unquote. It concerns, in other words, the place, time, materials, and tools as a necessary result of which something comes to pass. Cicero's second type of material cause, however, is based on the non-necessary relationship between the presence of certain circumstances on the one hand and the emergence of something coming to pass on the other. The relationship signified by this kind of materiality, material causality, defies any certainty of human knowledge, and this explains why Cicero relates it to the concept of fate, that is, the eternal, immutable laws of nature that exceed human understanding. But some causes exhibit a sort of preparatory process towards the production of the effect spoken of, and some of themselves do contribute to some aid to it, although it is not indispensable. As meeting may have supplied the cause to love, and love to crime. From this description of causes depending on one another in an infinite series is derived the doctrine of fate. Fate, in other words, comprises causes that are not necessary or that are not indispensable. At a later stage of his essay, Cicero adds two more classes of non-necessary causes. On the one hand, there are those that exhibit a certain uniformity or constancy, such as natural processes or processes that follow an artful or technical design. On the other hand, there are those that comprise processes which defy any form of constancy or uniformity. Among these latter are those that concern our judgment and our desires, as well as all the effects caused by chance or fortuna. Now, in order to distinguish these two, Cicero uses the keyword of latency. For what is effected by our judgment or our desires form evident causes, perspicuae. Causes that are subject to fortune, on the other hand, are classified as latent. What then is the difference between fate and fortune? As far as I can see, the effects caused by fate are not necessary to the extent that human cognition cannot understand the immutable laws of nature in their entirety. Therefore, we are not able to fully comprehend the precise extent to which certain phenomena necessarily prepared for or necessarily aided to the emergence of other phenomena. In contrast, effects caused by fortune do not primarily concern our understanding, but our actions, or rather, the action context in which certain events and effects emerge. Interestingly, Cicero leaves it entirely open whether results produced by fortune are intentional, voluntaria, or unintended, ignorata. For to shoot an arrow is an effect, an act of intention. To hit a man whom you did not mean to hit is the result of fortune. This is important because in the same context, Cicero refers back to the question of necessity. He states that effects that are ignorata, that is unintended and unknown, are produced by necessity, whereas those that are intended or voluntaria are produced by design, quae consilio. Fortune-based agency, therefore, comprises shades of both ignorata and of voluntaria. Fortune is therefore situated between free will and necessity. Let me sum up my remarks on Cicero's concept of latency. Whereas fate is an epistemological concept that refers to the human ignorance of the transcendent laws of nature, fortune is a practical notion that refers to an action context that belongs partly to our intentional will and partly to an agency that exceeds our voluntary intentions. Fortune is neither predetermined, such as fate's immutable course of nature, nor can we entirely control the effects of fortunate latency. Although, based on fortitude and prudence, we can at least try and sometimes, but not always, succeed. This explains the absolutely arbitrary and incalculable nature of the goddess Fortuna that Cicero points out in his treatise on divination. Surely, nothing is so at variance with reason and stability as chance. Hence, it seems to me that it is not in the power even of the goddess herself to know what event is going to happen accidentally and by chance. For if she knows, then the event is certain to happen. But if it is certain to happen, chance does not exist. And yet, chance does exist. Therefore, there is no foreknowledge of things that happen by chance. The accidental doings of Fortuna defy not only any kind of metaphysical predetermination comprised in the concept of fatum, but they also run counter against any hypothetical or theoretical form of knowledge that would allow us to calculate and understand future events according to the social logics of the usual or the habitual, or the modal logics of the probable, the possible, and the contingent. Instead, the concept of fortunate latency is correlated to a mode of being that enables and confirms an asystemic counter-contingency and thereby offers a leeway for radical novelty in terms of social experience and practice. This concept of fortunate latency offers an interesting way to describe the ontology of becoming typical of narrative fictions. My following reading of a passage from Stern's Sentimental Journey will tie this focus on the ontogenetics of fiction to the question of how the novel's novelty provides a social ethics that is specific of fictional ontologies. Here I will show that interacting under the fictional auspices of fortunate latency offers the potential for radically situational ethics in which, to quote Stengers, the very way we define or address a practice is part of the surroundings which produces its ethos. At the beginning of Stern's Sentimental Journey, Yorick, having just arrived in Calais, is at peace with man and at peace with the world. As a proof of his universal love of mankind, he exclaims, "Now was I a king of France. What a moment for an orphan to have begged father's portmanteau of me," and the text goes on. "I had scarce uttered the words when a poor monk of the Order of St. Francis came into the room to beg something for his convent. No man cares to have his virtues the sport of contingencies. But be this as it may, the moment I cast my eyes upon him, I was predetermined not to give him a single sou." And at a later stage of Stern's narrative, Yorick meets that monk again, and this is a scene which I will now explore in more detail without reading it out to you in its entirety because it's too long. But the gist of the whole thing is that they meet again. There is Yorick, the monk, and a lady who forms the constant object of erotic desire in the course of the first part of the novel. And while all what we will be talking about now is going on, Yorick's hand rests on the lady's hand that is in its turn covered by a glove where three fingers stick out, the thumb and these two. And so this is the scene in which what happens is described, and what actually happens is that the act of begging that the narrator refuses to answer and to respond to is converted miraculously, without any narrative motivation giving, in an act of giving, or into an act of a gift. The act of begging is transformed into an act of giving. Thereby, social interaction in Stern exceeds the distinction between subject and object, between alter and ego, human and non-human agents, nature and handicraft, mind and matter. Rather, through an iterative enactment of ever-changing experiences, the terms of these dichotomies become mutually entangled, and in this practical entanglement, sociality is formed as a process and as a relational reality. The idea, the narrator's idea of him, the monk, appears as if it were co-emergent with or simultaneous to the monk's physical presence and his actually being, quote, within six paces of us. Inversely, the monk's impetus to talk to his former tormentor realized, quote, a little out of the line, as if uncertain, unquote, as well as the monk's general frankness, appears to be equally caused by the material drift exerted by his wide-open horn snuff box, and is thus not entirely the result of an intentional act of confrontation or of reconciliation. The scene stages an intense communion comprising the narrator, the monk, and the lady, and it stages this communion not only in the spiritual sense, but also in the tactile sense of the word. It emerges through a diversity of objects and materialities that the characters are in a continuous process of responding to, through feelings of taste, mutual blushes, as red as scarlet, via effects to the nerves, or by means of friction performed on objects of tortoise and of horn, as well as through habits of textile, among the latter the sleeves of a tunic and the lady's black pair of silk gloves open only at the thumb and two forefingers mentioned before, and on which the narrator's hand is resting all the while. These things, in return, are characterized by complex interrelations in which material and immaterial entities coincide. The anticipated memories of a hearty pinch out of the snuffbox, for example, will, in an undefined future, have evoked the recollection of a, quote, peace offering, unquote, from the past. The actual encounter is thereby thickened with anterior confrontations which already overtake themselves into a future where contentions are overcome, or into an anticipated presence with further frictions to be expected. By acting in this entangled and thingly environment, the characters both relate to each other and enact their mutual concern. The associations effected through the disjunctive plurality of these material objects form the latent side of sociality. Its binding force appears precisely in excess over and in addition to the actual conditions of these material appearances. What is thereby achieved is nothing less and nothing more than the miraculous reversal of the monk's act of begging into a mutual exchange of gifts. In saying this, he presented his snuffbox to me with one hand as he took mine from me in the other. The ground for this alteration and reversal is not found in human nature. Neither can it be explained or justified by recourse to an ethical system. Nor can it be located in a transcendent sphere so suggestively marked by the monk's look at, quote, something beyond this world, unquote. Rather, the reasons for that something radically novel comes to pass needs to be situated in the imminent latency produced by the social fictional environment itself, as well as in the astounding perplexities of experience and practice it provides. Fictional environments offer sites where the absolute latency of being social and its potential for novelty is practically experienced and experienced as practicable. Thereby, fictional environments offer a radically open and extremely involved course of unrealized possibilities and real impossibilities. In the existential mode of fiction, these unrealized possibilities and real impossibilities are necessarily experienced and practiced upon as if they were real. In fictional environments, calculable contingencies or probabilities are constantly transformed into novel impossibilities and marvelous accidents. This is how fictional environments realize their potential of latency to enable and confirm counter contingency in its sheer being. Thank you very much.